for great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. This is the Freeman Report on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hello and welcome to the Freeman Report. I'm your host, James Freeman. It is Tuesday, the 26th of March, 2024. And for the next few minutes, I want to do something a bit different. I've got a great show lined up for you the next 2 hours, but I want to share some thoughts that I hope will inspire some of you that, like me, are worried about what is going on in the world. What I want to share is an important lesson that I have learnt this year. Now, the lesson I've learned is about how to be happy, which is such an obvious one in life, but something that is so easily and very often misconstrued and misunderstood. Since leaving university and getting married and having kids, I've always been in the pursuit of happiness like everybody else. I've worked hard across all of my different career moves, and I've done my best to bring up my children to be good people. And I've tried to give something positive to the world, even if a lot of the time that has been to fight what I perceive to be negative things in the world that threaten all of us and our combined happiness. If I just do this, that will make me happy, has been my mantra. But what I've now realised is that I have been chasing happiness, and in the process, I've forgotten what it actually means. It's not that I've been unhappy, because I'm lucky enough to have a great family and a great life, and I do a job that I would do even if I wasn't being paid. But I think in the process of doing all of the things that I've done to make me and my family's lives better, I think I forgot what being happy actually is. I've been rushing around so much in my life that I haven't stood still, not even for a moment. I spent so much time chasing one thing or another that I forgot to stand still and not to worry about the future. Now, over the past 4 years in particular, my instinct has been to prepare for the worst and to find some kind of safe haven. And like many, this has consumed me entirely. Not surprising, really, given what has happened. I mean, there's nothing like finding out that the power of the state is being used to kill lots of ordinary people as waking you up and, you know, consuming you. Realising that is a shocker, because how do you fight that? How do you run away from that? Which is probably one of the reasons why so many people don't open their eyes and see it, because it's just too scary a realisation to have. The truth is that you cannot run away from that, not when other governments are doing the same thing. So what changed? Well, last year I hit a milestone birthday and my wife bought me some motorcycle lessons and a motorcycle test, which if you listen to the show regularly, you will know that I passed and that I purchased a motorbike over Christmas. Now, the weird thing is about this, it wasn't the riding of the bike that made me remember. It was the thought of doing something by myself, of being alone and experiencing something just for fun. Just me and my thoughts, with only a mission to have fun. It brought back memories from when I was around 12 years old, living in Plymouth. At the time, I used to love going fishing. I would go with my dad and my granddad, but I would also go by myself. And remembering that made me remember the adventures that I would go on by myself, like riding my bicycle, age 12, 20 odd miles onto Dartmoor National Park to go trout fishing. Now, this was highly illegal, by the way, as I never had a license, and I was also fishing with worms, which is definitely not allowed. But that didn't concern me at that age. I remember catching a couple of trout and then dropping them off at my Auntie Sharon's on the way home, because my parents had no idea that I was riding 20 miles onto Dartmoor by myself. Of course, my auntie told my parents, but I think despite them telling me not to do it again, I think they were quietly proud that I'd done all of that by myself. Now, it's very strange indeed to have all of these memories flood back just because I'd got a motorcycle. I mean, why would these memories suddenly flood back? Well, I quickly realized that I never spend any time by myself going on adventures anymore. I suddenly wondered if I could even do that anymore, whether I would just get bored or feel the need to be around people, to be distracted. Can I enjoy time by myself anymore? You know, just being by myself and forgetting about all of the goals and tasks that I've set myself in life and just to do something with no other objective than just to have fun. What an odd question to ask, I thought. But I knew that the question was real and burning. And this isn't about getting away from the people around me, you know, like that typical middle-aged man. I don't know about it's typical, but, you know, in my mind, it's that middle-aged man who goes fishing to get away from the nagging wife or fighting kids. No, I've got wonderful people around me that I love spending time with. So it's not about that. No, what I realized is that in all of the rush to achieve things that would make me and my family happy, I'd forgotten to just stop now and again and to do something that involves nobody else, just me, by myself, with no mission other than to have fun. So what I've realized, remembered, or relearned, whichever, is that you don't have to share moments of happiness for them to be real, and you don't need to always be doing something that will result in a task or mission being completed. And yesterday I did something that broke the mold again. I went out and bought a puppy, a 9-week-old Whippet boy that I've named Wren after the British rapper. And by the way, if you haven't listened to Wren before, please, please, please make sure you listen to Hi Wren. It's a song that explores the singer's inner monologue. It is a truly amazing song, a piece of art. Go and check it out. It's called Hi Wren by British rapper Wren, and that is spelt R-E-N. Go and listen to it after today's show and thank me later. Now, the mad thing about getting a puppy is that we've been talking about it for ages, but I have found every reason why it wouldn't fit in with our plans. It would just make things more complicated. So now I will definitely be spending more time standing still, just having fun, not wondering if what I'm doing completes the missions that I've set myself, or wondering if I should be sharing this moment with someone else in real time. What I've realized is that by not standing still, I've been ignoring the whole point of everything that I do. Isn't that weird that in the pursuit of happiness, you can simply forget to actually be happy? Anyway, I thought I'd just share that. That's a lesson that I've learned. It feels quite profound to me. But I think, you know, with all of this social media, everything going on around the world, sometimes we do just forget, just to stop and put blank everything out, spend some time by yourself and just forget about the future, forget about the past, and just do something that makes you happy, something that's fun. Anyway, if you want to get in touch about anything on the show, email me at jamesfreeman@tntradio.live. And if you don't follow me or TNT on social media, then get yourself over to Facebook, X, Getter, or whatever your favorite platform is, and give us a follow. My name is James Freeman, and this is the Freeman Report for today's News Talk, TNT.
Russia, gas prices, COVID mandates.
It just doesn't seem like anybody's doing anything about it.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hello, Gemma.
Well, 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 James. I am. Oh, now, although we've got a really important story, Julian Assange, to talk about, I've got an update on that. This is an interesting editorial. It seems like you're in the depths of your midlife transition, which is a thing. It's an absolute thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, as you well know, I'm training to be a therapist. You know, God help the world, some may say. I've got years to go before I'm unleashed on the public, but we learn about these things, and the human psyche at midlife will not be ignored. All the things it's a thing.
I'm past 50 though, so I think calling it midlife is maybe a little bit misleading. But yeah, it's weird. Just suddenly, I mean, getting the motorbike, you know, that was just something fun. It was a bit frivolous. I even felt a bit guilty because I spent lots of money on it and it's just for me. And then that made me remember back. And it just suddenly I thought, geez, I haven't done that for ages. Just gone out and had fun by myself. And it's been quite profound, really.
Well, let me just define the midlife transition. It happens between the ages of 47 and 52, where you're the rumblings of the inner you, which is the inner child, basically, which wants to come back out and fulfill all those childhood passions and dreams that have been put on the back burner while we pursue happiness and we pursue the goals of the ego. The soul then comes to life between the ages of 47 and 52 and desperately tries to get your attention through all kinds of rumblings. And many people go into crisis mode because they don't know, understand the voice of the psyche and the soul, and they go off and they have affairs, or they get divorced, or they buy sports cars or motorbikes. I'm just kidding. because they're trying to find that lost aspect of childhood that, that the soul's demands come to the fore in the second half of your life. So you're absolutely textbook, but you're approaching it in the right way. Some people go off and have crises. I myself had a very tumultuous midlife transition. I'm just coming out the other side now. I mean, I don't want to philosophize. It's not what I get paid to do. But just hearing your editorial there, I mean, you're really on the right track to living a wonderfully fruitful second half of your life if you pay attention to that little 12-year-old on the bike who's now in their 50s on the bike. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm listening. So, yeah. Anyway, I don't want to take the whole show on a tangent. What have you got for us? I think we're going to talk about Assange, aren't we?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's the story now that dominated. It broke just over an hour ago. The ruling has come out. You know, it's a strange ruling. It's like they're trying to please everybody, these judges. Stella Assange has now appeared outside the High Court with this ruling. I mean, basically, the ruling is saying he's going to have to wait another 3 weeks. The judges want assurances from the United States that he will be protected under the First Amendment, free speech, and also, you know, whether he would face the death penalty, because extradition should have been barred on that basis, they're saying, possibly in the initial stages. And Priti Patel should not have signed this extradition order, knowing that the death penalty was an option, because extradition is actually barred by an adequate death penalty protection. So that they have made that in their statement. So Stella Assange has appeared outside of the High Court. She says she's astounded by the decision and is asking the US now and the Biden administration to drop this ridiculous case. She's called her husband a political prisoner. She says he's a journalist being persecuted because he exposed the true cost of war on human lives. And the case is a signal to all of you. She was addressing the crowd, which was considerable outside the Royal Courts of Justice, addressing the crowd, a signal to all of you that if you expose the interests of those that are doing war, they will come after you. The Biden administration should not submit any assurances to the High Court on anything and should drop this shameful case. This is a shame on every democracy. She then cried, "Free Julian." I ask everyone to rally behind him. And there was a huge court outside the Royal Courts of Justice. So Assange will have to wait till May the 20th to see if the US can give assurances to the judges on those two particular principles. Stella is saying that they shouldn't. It's something of political football in a way. I mean, it's good news for Assange that he's not on a plane at this very moment being flown over to the United States. But equally, it's a 3-week wait. And if the US can't bring these assurances to the judges, then he will be given right to appeal, and he will appeal. Who can appeal his extradition order? That will be another case then, and it will drag on and on and on. Obviously, the 3-week wait is another further toll. Assange's wife saying she's astounded. She wanted it obviously just to be a straight, you know, you can appeal. I wonder why they're giving the American administration and legal team the right to kind of fight their corner. Some would be saying enough is enough. There is no corner to fight. This case should be dropped. He's still not been charged with anything. And even Anthony Albanese waded in last month in the original hearing and said he was having diplomatic talks with the US as to whether Assange could be planted on Australian soil. He's an Australian citizen. Anthony Albanese hasn't made a statement on this yet. Obviously, the time difference might have something to do with that. But there have been protests outside the British High Commission in Melbourne just a few hours ago, Australian nighttime and evening rather. And it has got global interest. No two ways about that. This story has got the eyes of the world on it at the moment.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if, look, I think there's two roads which I can see this going down. One, they will just keep him locked up and they will delay and delay and delay. His health is deteriorating and they'll just keep on doing that. I'm sure they could drag this out for years doing that. Or are they looking for a way out of this, which doesn't look like some kind of defeat? That to me in this context would look like, well, the US government is going to come back and say, well, look, we cannot give protection under the First Amendment like we would US citizens, that would be setting a precedent, which would then be argued legally for other people around the world that were potentially bringing in, whether they're terrorists or whatever. So I wonder if this is the setup to make all of this go away, but without kind of having some big, we lost kind of thing. The Americans, it'll be a kind of stalemate, won't it? It'll be the Americans saying, well, we can't do that. We can't do that legally. And then the British say, well, if you can't do that legally, then we cannot let him extradited, because it's just UK law, you know, particularly that death penalty thing, if that could be used against him. It's a bit disappointing that it's going to be delayed once again, because I think every day at the moment for Julian is another day down this dark path. His health clearly I just can't imagine what it must have been like for him to be locked up in a high security prison, not charged with anything either. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that we were told when we were growing up that was the, you know, the work of China and Russia. Yet it's going on in the UK here. It's absolutely bonkers. So, yeah, it's very, very frustrating that it's going to be delayed even more. But Gemma, if you have any updates, you might have an update for the second hour of the show, then please let me know. Right. OK, as I said, I've got a great show lined up for you today. My first guest is Tim Scott. He's political commentator and former army captain. We're going to be talking about that announcement that Tory MP Scott Benton quit. Another one. He was caught lobbying or offering to lobby ministers for gambling companies, presumably for money or for other benefits. He's quit. It's a red wall seat in Blackpool South. So it's going to have another by-election, another problem for the government. I'm sure it's not they're not looking forward to another by-election. And it just says it's just another bit of evidence of how rotten and corrupt this Tory government is. So for all of that, don't go anywhere. Stick with me, James Freeman, right here on TNT.
TNT's Chris Smith.
I can tell you that Donald Trump is projected to win primaries in the states of Texas, Minnesota, Colorado, Virginia, Maine, Massachusetts, Arkansas, Alabama, Oklahoma, Tennessee, and North Carolina. And in a little bit of a turn up, the northeastern state of Vermont looks to have gone to his final rival, the former United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley. Now, Nikki Haley's team has said that she won't be speaking tonight. That has been construed by many of the reporters in that location as she's about to exit the race in the next 24 hours.
Chris Smith on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
The top of the hour, we'll keep on top of the news.
It's the most important thing we can do
on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Right, so another by-election in a red wall seat. What an absolute mess this Tory government is. Obviously, the Tory MP quit because he was offering to lobby ministers for gambling companies. I mean, I'm laughing, but I don't know what else to do, really, because it is just such a mess, this government at the moment. But anyway, I'm absolutely delighted that Tim Scott, who's a political commentator and former army captain, is with me now to discuss all of this. Hello, Tim.
Hi, James. Good afternoon, and thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming on the show. So, Tim, another by-election. What do you make of this?
Well, I think the infamous Brenda from Bristol summed it all up, didn't she? In 2017, you remember?
Yeah.
Not another one. So these by-elections, honestly, I mean, it's like buses, you know, you wait and then five turn up at the same time. So this is Scott Benton. And it's a Blackpool by-election, and forgive me for what I'm about to say, but it should be illuminating. And it's the Blackpool South, it's the Blackpool South seat, which is one of these so-called red wall seats. And actually, particularly with Lee Anderson and Ashfield, there's been a lot of talk about the red wall. And in fact, I rummaged through my bookshelves, and I've had another look through Sebastian Payne's really good book, Broken Heartlands, a journey through Labour's lost England, and he goes into all of these seats and interviews people. It's worth a read if you want to unleash your inner political geek. But it is one of these seats, and Scott Benton, as you quite rightly said at the beginning of this segment, another dodgy MP, and I think it's going to be really interesting to see how it goes. I mean, you've got to make Labour favourites. Scott Benton saying he's going to stand as an independent. I mean, he'll probably sink without trace. But, you know, let's see how Reform UK do as well, James.
Yeah, I mean, that was going to be my next question, because I haven't done any research to have a look at the demographic of Blackpool. But I could probably make a good guess on what the demographic is like. You probably got quite a big influx, I should imagine, of ethnic minorities, but also a lot of working class people. I think it's I don't think it's an area where wages are very high and there's lots of jobs. I think, you know, it's a pretty degenerated area. Which makes me wonder, actually, if Reform UK, it's the kind of seat that they could target, because, you know, by-elections usually have a very low turnout. So all you need is an extra, you know, to motivate an extra sort of 5% of voters to come out, voters maybe that don't normally vote in elections because they're so disenfranchised with the whole political system. I wonder if Reform UK can motivate people to come out.
Well, the demographics should be favourable for Reform UK, and Professor Matt Goodwin from Kent University has done a lot of good work on this, on some of the seats. I mean, Ashfield is another one. Some of these seats in Midlands and the North where the demographics would have been favourable for UKIP. I think Reform UK is an interesting one. We remember the rise of UKIP, and they started really to get themselves on the map through a series of by-elections. Most of which I was Southeast chairman at UKIP, covering 84 constituencies from Kent round to Oxford, and I must have, for my sins, I must have gone to most of those by-elections all over the place: Crosby, Clacton, Eastleigh, Rotherham, etc. But Reform UK, really, they haven't started to show well at by-elections, and I think it's probably about time that they did. I mean, I've got a foot in the Tory camp. I do have a Conservative membership, even though I think they should be sued under the Trades Descriptions Act for calling themselves a Conservative party. I also know Richard Tice a bit, and I went to the Reform UK conference in London. It's interesting to see how they're going. I'm not actually going to be a candidate for them. I stood for UKIP against Dominic Grieve here. Because I thought, well, somebody has to. But you're right, James. I mean, they need to start showing and actually coming up with some really good by-election results. And I think Blackpool South should be the kind of seat where you'd hope they put in a good showing.
Yeah, they should, shouldn't they? I mean, look, the smaller parties, the problem all of the smaller parties have is that, you know, whereas the big parties, they're established, they've been around, some of them, for, over 100 years. They have all of the infrastructure that the smaller parties don't have. So, for example, if you're a Conservative candidate, you will presumably have lots of councillors that are already elected to the council. Now, that's free resource because, they will be whipped to go out and deliver leaflets, to speak to people. You'll have lots of data going back decades and decades on what the voting trends are, what the demographics, where the people that vote live, all of these things that the smaller parties don't have. But I think you're right. This is, I think, a prime target for Reform UK. But I do wonder, I don't know what your thoughts are, Tim, on reform under Richard Tice. I've talked a lot on this show about the fact that I just don't think he connects very well with some of the voters that Reform UK should be doing very, very well with, because I think the accusation is that Richard Tice is Tory light. What are your thoughts on the party under Richard Tice?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, James. I mean, Reform is run on a bit of a shoestring budget compared to the other parties. And one thing Richard does deserve credit for is it's strongly rumoured that at times he's kept the party going out of his own pocket. They don't have the big guns and the big backers. I mean, there was recently this controversy about the guy who gave the Tories 10 million. I mean, you know, whether anybody should be able to give a party 10 million, whether any organ, you know, how much influence and power and connections are you buying with 10 million? I think Reform UK, they're starting to poll reasonably well nationally. There was a poll out recently with the Tories on 19 and Reform UK on 15. So they're only in that poll, at least they were only 4% behind. I mean, I think they're getting there. I think there's still question marks over their branch network. And I think they do seem to be a bit thin on the ground. I follow quite a few of their candidates on Twitter, and they very often have quite small, you know, virtually all of them have very small followings. So you do think, well, you know, how active are people being? And as for Richard, I mean, Richard's a great guy. You know, he's very personable. He's very approachable. But, you know, he's not Nigel Farage. And quite frankly, who is? Nigel seems to be playing a long game. I the word is that he will declare himself. But I think Nigel is, he's a master of political timing. And I don't think he wants to go too early. I think Richard's done a good job of keeping the party going and getting it to a respectable, a sort of half decent level. 15% is not bad. But I think, you know, I think, James, half the country has barely heard of Reform UK. I think Lee Anderson's defection will do them a lot of good. But then the Brexit party, you know, that was a new party as well. I think Nigel will give it boosters.
Yeah, I think, I think a lot of us, I mean, I did in the 2019 general election. I'd never had an experience of running in an election. My first experience was the European elections, which was a funny way to start, really, because, you know, I learned very, very quickly in later elections that election was very, very different from anything we've ever seen again. And we're probably that we'll ever see in our lifetimes again. I mean, I think your analysis or your conclusions about the fact that they haven't got local infrastructure is correct. That was the reason in the end, the last straw, which I actually left Reform, because, you know, we stood in the Welsh elections here. We built up some kind of infrastructure. We had 40 candidates standing, which was basically every seat in Wales. And then after the election, you know, it was just left to fall apart again. And I just thought, we're never going to win. We're never, ever going to win a seat trying to rerun that Brexit election where, you know, the last minute we get all of these new candidates that nobody's heard from before. We're scrabbling around at a local area trying to get resource boots on the ground. It's just not going to work. That's not how you win elections. You win elections by doing the really boring, gritty work locally, building up teams, building up infrastructure. And I just... that is the big question mark I've got for Reform UK. Nigel Farage is the magician. So who knows? But the one thing I will say before we go to the break quickly, Tim, is that I think if Nigel Farage comes back and leads the party, but doesn't stand himself, I think there's just not a hope in hell. Because if you remember back to the 2019 election under the Brexit party, Nigel refused to stand. He said that he would be better helping multiple candidates instead of focusing on his own. He got loads and loads of criticism for that, and lots of people saying, well, look, you know, you're either in it or you're not. So, you know, if I was going to give any advice from Nigel, I'm sure he doesn't need advice from me. That would be the one bit of advice, is make sure you stand yourself if you're going to come back. Right, Tim, we're going to take a quick break, but then we're going to come back. I've got loads more questions. I'd like to talk about this, the UK government talking about the security threat from China. And if there's any other political topic, hot potatoes at the moment you want to talk about. So don't go anywhere, Tim. Stay put right here on TNT.
What a news day this is turning out to be.
Let's finish it.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. Breaking news out of the UK, where the country's highest court has ruled WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange can appeal his extradition to the United States. A cargo ship has collided with a major bridge in the US city of Baltimore, causing the entire structure to collapse into the harbour. And farmers have rolled up to London in their tractors, protesting against ludicrous climate policies which they say are hurting their bottom lines.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
Right, now, Tim, let's talk about the threat from China, Russia, and Iran, because yesterday the UK government came out and said that it thinks that those three countries are helping to spread lots of stuff online, which is undermining British institutions. And I think they were referring to Kate Middleton and a lot of the conspiracy theories that are out there. I mean, my kind of thing with this is that, you know, it's the royal family which have created all of this speculation through their fake photos and potentially a fake video which came out last week, which seems to be AI if you run it through the software. But what are your thoughts? Is there a real threat from China, or do you think this is just a made-up thing for the UK government?
Yeah, well, we remember Reagan, President Reagan's famous phrase, axis of evil. I'll tell you who's very good on this is Ian Duncan Smith. And listeners and viewers of a certain vintage will remember him when he was leader of the Tory party. You remember, what was it? The quiet man is back and he's turning up the volume. He had a torrid time when Blair was in his pomp. But actually, he's carved himself out a bit of a niche, done some good work, introduced universal credit. But through my Tory membership, I actually went to a dinner a couple of weeks ago locally where he was the speaker. Now, he speaks very eloquently, and he's been on the radio and stuff, and he talks about this axis of authoritarian states. And I think there's no doubt that China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, they're a threat. They're a threat to the world. They're a threat to us. And I think we've got to be very, very careful with these guys and, you know, very wary of these guys. There's no doubt that there's been hacking attempts. We know that Russia launched they haven't just invaded Ukraine. They've launched hacking attacks against some of the Baltic states. And they have apparently, so we're being told, hacked the electoral commission, and they've got everyone's voter details.
Yeah, no, I kind of accept that. But do you not think that, you know, the MI6, the CIA, are not doing the same thing? I mean, you know, there's lots of evidence that Zelensky is an MI6 agent. And also, you know, when we talk about authoritarian states, I know China's bad. We've got the Uyghur people and, you know, they obviously want their spying, their social credit system on the Chinese people. But let's not remember that the UK government and governments around Western countries locked everybody in their homes and tried to force them to have injections, which there's a lot of evidence now, have done a lot of harms. Yeah. So, I mean, what to make of it in that context?
Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, these as somebody once said, these people may be buggers, but at least there are buggers. At least we can get rid of them at the next election. Although, you know, I suspect that what will follow if we get Labour will not be any better and maybe even worse. I mean, on the lockdowns, James, there's absolutely no doubt. I think that in many ways the lockdowns did almost as much, if not as much, damage as COVID. You know, schools should never have been closed. So, you know, for example, but I think there are these claims of vaccine harms. I wouldn't call myself an anti-vaxxer, although I'm not having any of the COVID boosters. At the moment, the NHS are trying to offer me about 5 vaccines, flu, booster, pneumonia. I mean, I thought, my goodness, I'll end up like a pincushion at this rate. I did have two jabs of AstraZeneca. And I did have some reasons for that, because I did need to travel for genuine reasons. It wasn't just I wanted a holiday. So, but I'm certainly not having any more COVID boosters. But I mean, on you know, Russia, China, etc. I mean, you know, we are not perfect, but at least we have governments that you know, are open and that we can get rid of. And I think particularly, I do worry about the threat to not just to Ukraine, but also to Taiwan, James. I don't know what you think about it.
I mean, it's a complicated one that I'm not sure how I feel. It is an island which is just off the China coast. I must admit, I'm not an expert on the history of this, but I think my big question would be to the United States, and I'm actually going to be talking about this in the next hour with a military, a lieutenant colonel, former lieutenant colonel, is, you know, what's all this noise from America? What can it do anyway? Does America really think that it's going to do anything if China invades Taiwan? It's thousands and thousands of miles away from America. America is fighting both in, even though it's not declaring it, it's got a proxy war in Russia. It's in the Middle East trying to stop everybody attacking Israel. Well, Israel does whatever it is doing to the Palestinian people. So, you know, when we talk about Taiwan, it's like, well, so what? What are the Americans going to do anyway? Nothing.
Yeah, I would hope that they would be able to put up enough of a deterrent to make China think that if we invaded, the cost, not just the military cost. I mean, Russia's had huge casualties in Ukraine, but of course, these countries don't really care too much about. They don't have to care too much about public opinion and about casualties. So I think they would hope to say China to realize the cost of invading. But of course, just something that came out this morning, I'm sure you're following the Julian Assange case, you know, very mixed views there. I after 7 years in the embassy and 5 years in Belmarsh, you would hope he'd had enough. But, you know, America's hands are not clean either, as we've seen with some of the stuff that Julian Assange has put out there.
Yeah, and this is part of the problem. I think, you know, people in Western societies now, in fact, a lot of people, I would suggest, in the West now, are looking to Russia and thinking, well, Putin seems to be talking sense, and our own governments are more of a threat. Now, what the reality of that is, and whether that's, you know, got any substance to it, no idea. But, you know, our governments, I think people are waking up to the fact that our governments are not, like you said, got clean hands in all of this. I think this conflict in Ukraine could have been avoided. I do think that, you know, NATO has been poking the bear for far too long, and it was always going to get a response in the end. But anyway, Tim, we have run out of time, but please do come back on the Freeman Report, because there's loads we can talk about in the next couple of weeks.
My pleasure, James. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much, Tim Scott, ladies and gentlemen. Right, okay, we're going to take a quick break now. And when we come back, I'm going to be speaking with Chris Morrison, who is the environment editor of the Daily Skeptic. So we're going to be talking, well, I'm going to be asking him if the weather is really getting worse, as the scientists or so-called scientists are telling us. So stick with us right here on TNT.
I was such a young age. Everything changed. My name is Chloe. When I was 13, my dad was diagnosed with cancer. When I found out, I just didn't know how to react. I felt like everything was just kind of closing in on me. It just became a routine. Dad's doing chemo. I'd come home from school, wait for mum to finish work, and we'd go straight to the hospital, spend a few hours there, just draw. It was hard to navigate going to school. Hundreds of kids, and I was the only one with a dying dad. He was diagnosed in March, and then he died in October. Towards the end, I heard about canteen. It kind of felt nice to know that they had other people like me. They understood what I was going through, and we didn't even have to chat about cancer. In 2020, I became a youth ambassador, so I can help others the way they helped me. I've done so many things since I was 13. I've graduated high school, university, gotten my license, made a move across the country. Life now is just a whole lot more fun. Please give a gift today to support more young people like me experiencing cancer.
Life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome. Prediabetes does. One in three adults has prediabetes, but with early diagnosis, prediabetes can be reversed. And you can change the outcome. Take the 1 minute prediabetes risk test today. Go to doihaveprediabetes.org.
James Freeman on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Right. So we're told the weather is getting worse constantly. You know, we've been told that it's warming up, that, you know, the storms are becoming more frequently, the rain is harder, floods are more, and it's all due to that pesky CO2. But is that really the case? Is the weather really getting worse? Well, to talk about all of this, I'm delighted to be joined by Chris Morrison, who is the environment editor of The Daily Skeptic. Hello, Chris.
Hi there, James. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you for coming on the Freeman Report. Obviously, this is the first time on the show. So, Chris, tell us, is the weather actually getting worse?
Well, I think it's probably getting better, actually. I hate to disappoint all the alarmists and all the people in the world who think the world is going to end in, sometime next Tuesday. But it probably is getting better. We're coming out of a 40 million year ice age. That needn't necessarily detain us. There have been lots of ups and downs in the meantime. But we're at a very cool period in the climate's history, and it's become ever so slightly warmer, tiny amounts really, since the Little Ice Age, which was another cycle. And in that time, the temperature has warmed in, let's say, 300 years, 1 degree centigrade. And what we've essentially had is slightly milder winters, and we've had a substantial greening of the planet, which was caused essentially by CO2 being released by the slightly warmer temperatures in the oceans and this kind of thing. So the reason I think that everybody or a lot of people think that the weather is getting worse is that this is now the main weapon used by climate alarmists to nudge us into the collectivist net zero global project. The temperature has been a bit of a problem over the last 25 years. It's paused. It hasn't gone up as much as the nice little jump they had from about 1976 to about 1998 or so. It hasn't behaved itself. The warming there has been tend to be spikes caused by natural variations such as El Nino. We've had the recent Hunga Tonga volcano, which is attracting a certain amount of interest. And so what they've had to do is they're reduced to looking out the window and saying, oh, look, it's raining very hard. The climate is collapsing. That's essentially the rather sort of silly narrative that they are reduced to. But if you look, though, at across the world, you will see that many of the things that they say are not getting worse. And the biggest problem they have with catastrophizing extreme weather is that the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the UN body, doesn't actually seem to agree with them. It is a biased organization. It is essentially there to prove that carbon dioxide is the control knob for climate change. But there are plenty of good scientists on the IPCC. We recently wrote an article in the Daily Skeptic where we referenced the sixth assessment report, where they talk about the low likelihood of human involvement. And I'll just read out, if I may, all of the weather events that they say are low likelihood. There's been no little or no evidence that humans have caused them to change up until now. And they say up until 2100, there's little evidence that it will change. So this is what they say. They say the following. I just need to get it here. River floods, heavy rain, pluvial floods, landslides, droughts, all types, fire weather, severe winter storms, tropical cyclones, sand and dust storms, heavy snowfall, ice storms, hail, snow avalanche, coastal flooding and erosion, and marine heat waves. And that doesn't leave a lot really, for the catastrophists to get their teeth into, to point out that, you know, we are causing these enormous changes in the climate. So what they've done is that you probably come across it. They've gone down this route of attribution studies. The IPCC doesn't give them any great backing for their nonsense. The temperatures have stopped behaving, and a lot of the data is corrupt anyway, but that's another story. And so they've gone down this route, and in certain parts of science, this pseudoscience attribution service, the biggest one probably is here in London. It's called the Weather Attribution Service. It's widely quoted on mainstream media, including the BBC. And basically what they do is that they have a computer model. Of course, it's a computer model. And they, first of all, imagine a climate without what they say is the carbon dioxide caused by humans. And then they imagine another climate where they put in the all of the CO2 that they say is caused by humans. And they run the two. And then they look at the two data sets and they assume, say the magic word, abracadabra. They might tap the results with a conjuring stick or something like that. And then any difference between the two, they say, oh, that's due, therefore, that weather event there was caused, that individual weather event was caused by human involvement. It's absolute pseudoscience drivel. It's nonsense on sticks. But this now is, if you like, really what they're reduced to. Because the whole concept of extreme weather, Professor Cliff Mass, an atmospheric scientist in America, says that extreme weather events, the one thing it's not likely to be caused by is any increase in human CO2. If you study science and you're looking for changes in the long-term climate, you look at these, you know, particularly heavy cyclone or a hot day or whatever, and you ignore them to a certain extent. They're an anomaly, we're looking on long-term changes in climate. We're looking for an average, a means of direction, and so to therefore take individual events is misleading. And as I say, there's no great evidence that they're increasing anyway. They invent these attribution models to suggest there is. And the whole thing is, it's not very scientific.
Yeah, I mean, I've had Judith Curry on the show before. She was obviously a IPCC scientist herself. Once she retired and she wasn't sort of captured by the system, she obviously started to speak out freely. And she's said very, very similar things to you, that a lot of these models that are used to predict this are exactly that. They're models. You know, we've seen all the COVID modelling and what an absolute load of nonsense that is. But I guess it's more difficult, isn't it, to prove these models wrong with something like the weather globally, because these things happen over, you know, not a few years. They happen over hundreds and thousands and even millions of years. Now, Chris, do you remember those emails? I forget where they were leaked, but there was a load of leaked emails, and I think it was between 2010 and 2015, and it was between governments. And what the emails are essentially saying was that, bugger, the weather isn't doing what we predicted it is. This is a problem because it means our agenda now is going to get questions. What do we do? I remember those emails, and I think that kind of states very, very clearly what is going on here. The other thing I've always wondered, Chris, and you might be able to answer this, is, you know, when we see like these record temperatures, for example, and there were a lot of questions in the UK when we had our record temperatures, I think it was either last year or the year before, I think it might have been last year. And, you know, there was lots of question marks over the place. Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to ask you, because I think some of these temperatures, they were called record, but they were taking from some of them airport runways, which you think, you know, that's going to be the hottest place. I mean, what's the history of that?
We've covered that in great detail. We had there was a record temperature of 40.3 centigrade, which was July the 19th, 2022, and it was all over the mainstream media. Conersby, it was called, but more accurately, it would be it was RAF Conersby, and it was halfway down the runway. And we got hold of the actual, it was at 312, that particular temperature. We got hold of the records every minute from 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock. And we found that at 310 to 312, there was a spike of 0.6 centigrade. The record, use it in quote marks, stood for 60 seconds, and then lo and behold, within 2 minutes, falling back 0.6. And we then did a subsequent Freedom of Information Act here in the UK, and we found that there were no less than three typhoon jets landing at around that time. And this, it's become a national joke. I mean, you know, this was the so-called record. But we've recently done another Freedom of Information Act, Freedom of Information request on the Met Office. And this was a very interesting one. We asked, there are 380 weather measuring centres in the United Kingdom. And the World Meteorological Office grades them from class 1 to class 5, class 1 being pristine, in the middle of nowhere, you get an accurate temperature of the surrounding area. Class 5 is essentially junk. It doesn't even have any sort of suggestions to where it can be. It could be next to a blast fire furnace or an ice rink, you know. And class 4 is does actually have some, you know, suggestions. Class 4 comes with uncertainties, you call it margin of error, but uncertainties of 2 centigrade. Class 5 comes with uncertainties of 5 centigrade. Now, I could ask the question, it's rhetorical. We, out of the 380 weather stations of the Met Office run in the UK, how many were class 4 and class 5, near junk and junk status? And I'll tell you, nearly 80%. Nearly 8 out of 10, 77% it was, of weather stations that the UK Met Office is using to produce these figures are essentially at near junk or junk status, with enormous variations in possible in temperature. And yet, they told us last year was only 0.06 centigrade cooler than the record. So they're using these temperatures that have uncertainties up to 5 centigrade to tell us what the record temperatures are within 1/100th of a degree. That's how ridiculous it is. And we wrote this article and we asked the Met Office to reply, but for some reason they refused to take back my calls. This is what's happened, because it was also replicated in America. Anthony Watts is a well-known meteorologist. He's done work on this for the last 10 years, and he found that 96% of these temperature stations, which are all in these sort of, you know, urban areas, next to runways, all sorts of things, 96% were fatally corrupted. That, you know, that, yeah, that you can use these temperature stations to get, you know, in the old days, they were fine, because you want to know roughly seasonal information, you want to know trends, you want to know local stuff. That's what they were designed for. And then, of course, urbanization, industrialization over the last 70 years, many of these stations are now surrounded by tarmac buildings, typhoon jets landing, whatever, you know, and they are producing this false rise in temperature. So yes, that, in the short answer, that is what we went through in 2022, and that's what they're still doing. They are still using this temperature. They still use it to, you know, promote their climate collapse narrative. They are junk figures. I'm sorry to say it, but they are junk. I mean, on the World Meteorological Organization's own class records, they're junk.
Yeah, and what do you make about, because I remember when all of this was happening, you know, where we had the wildfires and we had all these temperatures in Italy. And, you know, we were being told by Sky News and all the other UK outlets that these temperatures are unparalleled. You know, they're really, and then you'd look at the actual temperature, the weather forecasts, and, you know, you'd see differences of 5, 6, 7 degrees between what you're being told in these alarmist stories and the actual weather reports that you're getting from the Met and from other sources. I mean, it's really good to hear the detail behind that. I'd always kind of felt that was the case, but it's great to actually hear that from the horse's mouth. Now, Chris, the other thing that we've seen, I think, which has really brought to everybody's attention the scam that is going on, is the fires themselves that we saw lots of them last year, some of them in Greece, some of them, I think, in Italy. We might have seen some in Spain as well. And of course, all the headlines were that this is climate change. And then, of course, we found out that a lot of it was down to arson. Now, I don't necessarily want to talk about that, because we know that now. You know, we learned about that at the time. But when credible scientists around the world that believe that they're doing this work and they're seeing all of this. Do you think that there is, do you think many of them are actually questioning what they're part of and what's actually going on? Do you think there's any credible scientists that are actually questioning this?
Well, have you seen this new movie from Martin Durkin, Climate the Movie, which has gone viral?
I haven't yet, no.
I would recommend you and all of your viewers watch that. I mean, before it's completely banned, it's all been shadow banned by YouTube and all that sort of stuff. And the mainstream media are determined not to mention it. The only people who've sort of, you know, critically reviewed it are just Smog, which is that dreadful blacklist site, and Skeptical Science, which is not skeptical at all, and they don't really count. But all the rest of the mainstream media are determined not to mention it, but it is going around.
Sorry to interrupt, Chris, but we have run out of time. So I think it's what's really important is people find that film? Where can people find that film?
Well, type into Google. I mean, you'll find it's still up all over the place. It's called Climate the Movie, Martin Durkin and Tom Nelson. It's an hour and 20 minutes. And if you're at all skeptical, it will change your life, I would say. And I don't have anything to
fantastic.
Do with it. Fantastic film.
Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show. You'll have to come back on the Freeman Report again. There's loads more I think we can talk about. But Chris Morrison, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much, Chris.
Thanks a lot.
Right, okay, we're going to take a short break now and we'll be back for the second hour of the show. So don't go anywhere. Stick with us right here on TNT.